Of course, you've heard of punk rock. What about pub rock? I didn't think so. Pub rock was a musical movement in England that helped pave the way for the UK punk rock scene. Here's, to the best of our knowledge, producer and junior pub rock correspondent, Doug Gordon, with the story of pub rock.
Come on, it's time to leave the bar, everybody down the front. Buy your drinks later on. The one and only Nick Lowe's Late Saturday. Come on!
It's called I Knew the Bride When She Used to Rock and Roll.
Well, the bride looks a picture in the gown that her mama wore when she was married herself nearly 27 years before. They can change the style just a little, but it looks just fine. Stayed up all night, but they got it finished just in time.
That's Nick Lowe's last chicken in the shop with I Knew the Bride. Nick Lowe is one of the major players in the pub rock movement, which happened in the United Kingdom in the mid to late 1970s. Will Birch was the drummer in a pub rock band called the Kersall Flyers. Birch is also the author of a book called No Sleep Till Canvey Island, The Great Pub Rock Revolution. And although he's written a book about pub rock, Will Birch is not a fan of the name.
It's not a term that I'm particularly fond of because it doesn't really tell you very much about the music, but it does tell you about the atmosphere in which the music was made. The pub rock circuit in London really came about through sheer necessity. There wasn't anywhere for unknown groups to play really in the early mid-70s unless they had a record deal or a powerful management. You just couldn't get gigs, so somebody needed to set up a circuit. But the groups that played on that circuit were very disparate in their musical styles. Okay, it was rootsy R&B, country rock, R&B, bluesy, rock and roll, but those groups were very, very different.
Indeed. Pub rock covers a wide range of music, all the way from the hyper-caffeinated Chuck Berry rhythms of Lou Lewis Reformer to the music hall Cajun Boogie Woogie of Jonah Louie. Pub rock helped me to develop good taste in music. That's my opinion anyway. I was lucky enough to come of age during the pub rock explosion. Pub rock conveyed an enthusiasm and musical joie de vivre that was missing from other music. So, Will Birch, what exactly is pub rock?
Nick Lowe described pub rock to me as the regrouping of a bunch of middle-class ex-mods who had been through the hippie underground scene, taken LSD and decided it wasn't their cup of tea. And what he was really alluding to was, I think that most of the English guys that came up through those pub rock groups were born perhaps at the latter part of the 1940s, early 50s, so they were in their early 20s when the pub rock circuit opened up. And they'd been mods in the 60s and they'd perhaps, you know, followed the Small Faces and the Who, and they'd been into Motown and Stax and Otis Redding and that kind of music. And then when everybody grew their hair and dropped out sort of thing in 67 and started listening to, I don't know, the Grateful Dead or those groups that played long solos and stuff, a lot of those mods went through that scene and they came out the other end, 71, 72, deciding, hey, let's get back to our roots, and by that meaning the short, snappy songs of the soul and Motown era.
And who started pub rock? A couple of chaps named Stephen Warwick and Edward Moulton, although pub rock wasn't part of their original plan.
Stephen Warwick was trying to raise money to launch what he called the Pleasure Dome. And the Pleasure Dome was a rusting fort, a World War II landing stage in the Thames estuary, which he was going to convert into a sort of a hippie fun palace where people go and sort of smoke dope and dream all day. So Stephen Warwick needed money for the Pleasure Dome. He bumped into Eddie Moulton. Eddie Moulton said, I'll get you money.
And exactly how were Warwick and Moulton going to get money?
The other idea they had was to make a film about the card game Bridge. People who play bridge are wealthy people, by and large, who've got a lot of disposable income and can afford to buy expensive motor cars and apartments. But they don't watch TV, these people. There's no way the advertising media could reach them. But they felt that if somebody could make a television series about bridge and sell it to a TV network, it would bring together this well-heeled, affluent audience who were mad for playing bridge with the advertisers who could advertise the fancy motor cars. So they set about making a film called Bridge, and one of the world's most famous bridge players was the movie star Omar Sharif. And they persuaded Omar Sharif to take part in what they called the bridge circus. So they got some top flight bridge players and they filmed them for 2 days playing bridge in a hotel in London. And then they tried to sell it to the TV networks, but I don't think they were successful. And it was when the bridge circus collapsed financially that the race was on to raise money. And the next thing that they had was the management of a pop group that happened to be called Brinsley Schwartz.
Unfortunately, this was in 1970. Warwick and Moulton were ahead of their time. If only it were some 30 years later and they were pitching a TV show about poker, things might have been different. Warwick and Moulton crossed paths with an Irishman named Dave Robinson. Together, the three formed a pop music management company called Fame Pushers. Then, Fame Pushers started looking for an unknown group that they could turn into international superstars. Again, one could make the case that Warwick and Moulton were ahead of their time. Anyway, Dave Robinson discovered a band named Brinsley Schwartz. The band was named after their lead guitarist, Brinsley Schwartz. Yet Nick Lowe was the band's lead singer and main songwriter. So one could make a case for calling Brinsley Schwartz the band Nick Lowe. But we really don't have time to get into all that now.
But he was in his teens, yeah. He had to spill the beans. Still looking for ways and means to surrender to the rhythm that is calling him home. I used to say if it's right or wrong.
Now, Dave Robinson just had to come up with a plan to get Brinsley Schwartz some publicity. And boy, did he come up with a plan. Brinsley Schwartz would open for Van Morrison at the Fillmore East in New York City. And a plane load of British music journalists would be flown to the show so that they could review it. Unfortunately, things didn't go according to plan. The plane arrived in New York about 9 hours late, a mere 40 minutes before the Brinsleys were due to take the stage. And the critics had had a few too many drinks.
The media wasn't in a very receptive mood by the time the Brinsleys, as we know them, came on stage. And to cap it all, really, they weren't a terribly good group, and they didn't really do a very good performance. I think they were very nervous, and there were sound problems. So the whole thing was a complete disaster. So apart from the fact the media had this opportunity to have 24, 40 hours in New York and have a great time, the actual reason why they'd gone there to see this group was completely diminished, and they started writing up their reviews, and they came back, and really, to a man, every journalist more or less said, well, we had a good fun time, but the group were rubbish. I'm the biggest Brinsley Schwartz fan in the world, but I'm pretty sure that in April 1970, they weren't exactly the most impressive show business item.
Oh, yes, I love my label, and my label loves me.
Fast forward 6 years, 1976. Brinsley Schwartz has broken up. And their former manager, Dave Robinson, is about to reinvent the record industry with a fellow named Jake Riviera. Together, they create Stiff Records, the world's most flexible label. Stiff Records released the music that the big record companies wouldn't, a lot of it by pub rock groups and performers, such as Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello. Stiff was famous for its smart marketing. What I call smarketing, one of the label's slogans was, if it ain't stiff, it ain't worth a beep. Another slogan was, if they're dead, we'll sign them. And how about this one, found on the label of a Stiff compilation album? In 78, everyone born in 45 will be 33 and a third.
I ride a mill with a pick of steel. I back a spell with a loaded wheel. Shoes and tie made a rhino hide. I keep an eye on the countryside. I'm hunting, shooting, fishing. I head off the path.
This is Dr. Feelgood, along with Brinsley Schwartz, one of the most significant pub rock bands.
Dr. Feelgood weren't, by any stretch of the imagination, punk rock. They just played R&B pretty much like the Rolling Stones, only a bit faster. But they had a look, shorter hair, tighter trousers, and an on-stage aggression that appealed to the largely male teenage audiences. And those kids that hooked into the Feelgoods and made the Feelgoods into a big group were the same kids that became the audience the following year for the Sex Pistols and the Clash. So you could say that the Feelgoods really primed that audience, because I don't think that had the Sex Pistols have come along without the audience already existing, they would have happened quite as easily as they did. You know, the Sex Pistols took off very quickly because there was an audience ready for it. But had that audience not have been primed, in my opinion, by the Feelgoods, I don't think it would have been quite as easy for the Sex Pistols or the Clash or any of the other groups.
So what is pub rock's legacy?
I guess pub rock's legacy, in a very extrapolated, probably far-fetched theory, but right now we're seeing a return to the power of the song as being the central currency of music. I mean, we're now into the MySpace era, so things have changed very quickly in the last 2 years. But even before that exploded, if you go back just a couple of years, young up-and-coming groups were more interested in writing songs, and they would become very conscious of the way they packaged themselves and the image and the whole business orientation. And really, the seed of that, I think, was Stiff. Stiff Records gave rise to the independent music scene here in the UK, and record labels like Rough Trade and Creation. All right, different music, but the guys who started those labels were inspired to do so by the Stiff model.
In the deserts of Sudan and the gardens of Japan, from Milan to Yucatan, every woman's every man. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me, hit me. Je t'adore, ich liebe dich. Hit me, hit me, hit me. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me slowly, hit me quick, hit me.
That's Ian Drury and the Blockheads with Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. That song was Stiff Records' first number one single in the United Kingdom back in 1979. Will Birch is the author of No Sleep Till Canvey Island, The Great Pop Rock Revolution. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon.